It's great. I mean, this whole tradition is family. You know, I'm a product of the same thing. You know, I grew within the family context, and so it feels natural to do the same and give my son the same experience that I had. But of course, yeah, sometimes I forget about that fact, you know. But it's obviously it's great to be able to have your child involved in everything you're doing, and also as passionate about it as well. It's obviously a blessing. So yes, beautiful.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen beim Elbphilharmonie Talk. Vielen Dank fürs Einschalten. Ich heiße Ivana.
Und ich bin Chantal.
Chantal, du hast in dieser Folge mit Sona Jobate gesprochen, einer großen Kora-Spielerin aus Gambia. Das ist eine traditionelle westafrikanische Stegharfe. Und ihr habt euch nach ihrem Soundcheck unterhalten. Was hat sie denn für einen Eindruck auf dich gemacht?
Ja, sie war sehr entspannt, hatte ich das Gefühl, hat sehr viel Freude gehabt im Saal. Das ist ja auch ein wahnsinnig schöner Saal, weil man ja da wirklich umgeben ist von dem Publikum. Und ich glaube, das ist eigentlich genau das, was sie eigentlich auch mit ihrer Musik erreichen möchte, dass sie eben, sie kommt ja aus einer Griot-Familie, die also Geschichten erzählen, die Tradition weitertragen durch Singen, durch Instrumente spielen. Und da so inmitten einer Gesellschaft zu sein, das ist ja genau der richtige Ort. Und ich glaube, das ist genau das, wo sie ihre Musik platzieren möchte. Sehr beeindruckendes Instrument fand ich das. Also ich habe wenig Berührung bisher damit gehabt, so eine Stegharfe, 21 Saiten, die auch gestimmt werden wollen. Und wir haben halt auch darüber gesprochen, wie man so ein Instrument herstellt, was eben auch Teil der Tradition ist.
Ja, ist ein total interessantes Instrument. Mit dem war sie auch schon 2023 in der Elbphilharmonie. Das war ihr erstes Konzert in Hamburg, damals im kleinen Saal, diesmal eben im großen Saal. Und damals ist sie im Rahmen des Internationalen Musikfests Hamburg aufgetreten, 2023 unter dem Motto Liebe, und ich finde, das passt super gut zu ihrer Musik. Das ist eigentlich ein Perfect Match, weil ihre Musik klingt super warm, hat etwas Verbindendes, und sie spricht ja auch über Werte in ihrer Musik, über Gemeinschaft, über Zusammenhalt, über gegenseitigen Respekt.
Ja, das ist ja, glaube ich, das Ziel ihrer Musik und ihres Tuns überhaupt. Also das ist ja auch der Ansatz der Griot-Familie, die Tradition weiterzutragen und dem immer etwas Neues hinzuzufügen. Also es bleibt ja nicht bei einer Geschichte, die weiter tradiert wird, sondern es ist eben mündliche Überlieferung im besten Sinne, wo jeder eine ganz persönliche Geschichte beiträgt und sich dadurch die Geschichte verändert. Und das geht bei ihr eben so weit, dass sie auch sich um die Kultur in Westafrika bemüht, in Gambia eben, und dort eine Schule gegründet hat. Da haben wir auch sehr ausführlich drüber gesprochen. Es ist also eine sehr vielfältige Künstlerin, die sich nicht nur auf ihre Musik beschränkt.
Ja, obwohl sie ja zwischendurch auch in London gelebt hatte, in London studiert hatte, sehr viel rumgereist ist. Sie hat an der renommierten Purcell School und am Royal College of Music studiert. Und zwar Cello, Klavier, sogar Cembalo, was total überraschend ist, und Komposition. Und mittlerweile reist sie auf der ganzen Welt rum, hat die großen Konzertbühnen für sich erobert und hatte aber eben diesen starken Bezug noch zu Gambia.
Und tatsächlich, ich habe sie auch kurz darauf angesprochen, ihre Professoren haben da gar nicht so dran geglaubt, dass man eben mit dieser traditionellen Musik, mit den traditionellen Instrumenten so erfolgreich sein kann. Und ich finde es halt schon erstaunlich, dass sie, also um ein klassisches Instrument gut zu spielen, muss man sich ja schon sehr ins Zeug legen und sehr viel Stunden investieren. Und dass sie mehrere Instrumente wirklich studiert hat, eine Aufnahmeprüfung geschafft hat, um dort angenommen zu werden, das ist ja nicht irgendein College, sondern das ist eine relativ renommierte Musikuniversität. Und dann eben aber nochmal einen ganz anderen Weg zu gehen und da eben so seine ganz eigene Stimme zu finden mit der Musik und mit ihrer ja auch wahnsinnig schönen Gesangsstimme.
Ja, und das unausgebildet. Sie hatte im Gespräch erzählt, dass sie eigentlich nur singt, weil sie niemanden gefunden hat für ihre Musik.
Das hat mich auch total überrascht, weil ich finde ihre Stimme wirklich wahnsinnig schön und auch total klar. Und also man hört das gar nicht, und es wirkt, also es ist ein natürliches Instrument natürlich, aber das sie im besten Sinne gut ausgebildet hat, aber eben, ja, autodidaktisch.
Ja, ich bin auch total begeistert von ihrer Stimme, der Musik, der Chora und auch einfach ihrer Art. Einfach eine total coole Person. Wir möchten jetzt aber nicht zu viel vorwegnehmen und wünschen euch viel Freude beim Zuhören. Viel Spaß.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Yes, Sona, nice to meet you. I was very much looking forward to meeting you and talking to you. And there are a lot of interesting topics we could talk about today. But let's start with the concert hall, which is, yeah, quite unique concerning layout and acoustic. Mm. And yeah, how do you feel in this concert hall?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, we've played halls like this. It's always interesting, you know, when you have the round, you have audience behind you as well as in front. It's nice. I just hope that they they hear the best thing as well back there, but I'm sure the acoustics work out. But it's nice in the sense it kind of makes you feel, it's a different energy at least from audiences that are just in front of you only. So I actually kind of like it. I actually quite like the round, the audiences in the round. It's very unique.
Yeah, to be surrounded by the audience, I think it's, nice. It's just what you want with...
Exactly. The energy is coming from all sides.
Yeah. And how is traditionally, how do the Griots play? Do they play in front of the kings or are they among them?
It's not a tradition that has a stage. You know, it's integrated into, very much into, it's an integral part of events, of ceremonies and so on. So there's nothing like, a stage or the separation of performer versus audience. So in a way, this kind of venue is a little bit more natural to this type of music as well.
Can you tell me from your family, you grew up as a daughter from a Griot family, a very famous Griot family. Music and storytelling has a big importance for your family. How did you come to this in your family?
Well, for me personally, it would be similar to, generations of us now. It's a tradition that goes back, 700 years plus. So it's very ancient, and the whole process of inheritance is still very, very strong, very important, even in, modern society. Today, where a lot of people move abroad, because the economics of being a musician now is quite difficult when you just stay in Gambia or wherever your family's from. So a lot of the recent generations move abroad, work abroad, tour and so on. So it's sometimes can be more challenging to keep this tradition where it relies on inheriting, which means you really need your elders around. You need to be growing around them and learning from them. And so I think some generations are not having quite the same kind of experience. But at the same time, despite all of that, the tradition is very much still alive and still being maintained and still preserved. And there's still, from my generation, so many people who are still doing this and pushing the boundaries of it more as well. What I'm working hard to do is contributing to making sure that the next generation, like my son's generation, is also still finding relevance and finding a true way of expressing themselves in this tradition and not leaving the culture.
But normally in the tradition is that the fathers gave it to the sons and the son to his son, the father to his son,
exactly,
and so on.
Yeah.
And what about daughters?
So you mean me or just generally?
Just
daughters?
Generally, yes.
Oh, daughters. Yeah, I mean, it's the tradition itself is larger than the kora. The kora is one instrument within this tradition. So women are traditionally singers. They take the role of being the orators, singers. So the instrumental tradition, which would be the kora and also the balafon, which is the instrument that my son plays, is still mainly held within the male side of the families. And historically, that has been the case more because of the social role that the music played. As I mentioned a bit earlier, music is very integrated to the function and the society, the social functions that it serves. It's not simply, women can't play kora. It's what role did the kora play and what role do women contribute to that role. And that's something that that is what gave birth to the separation of roles for men and women. But obviously what I, push for in this day is that, the social functions have changed. And so this is where I question whether we should still be maintaining the gender divide along those lines when the function of the kora has changed, the function of rather the instrumentalist has changed. And so this is where I think that evolution needs to keep up with the evolution of society.
And you learned it from your brother and later on from your father. But what is told in your family about your grandfather and your, the whole family? What do you remember what was told?
I mean, I learned most of what I learned about my grandfather. I mean, I still obviously remember my grandfather. He passed away when I was about 11, I think, or so. But obviously I was not... serious in music at that time, although obviously I was studying and so on, but my career by no means was in my head.
You was in London too at this time?
No, there, but my focus was not in you know, I'm doing it because this is what I'm doing. But in terms of, you know, having the maturity in your head to really absorb in a different way, you know, your grandfather and his expertise is a very different experience as a child. So I really rely more as somebody that then wanted to develop professionally. I relied more on my father recounting and educating me and teaching me about my grandfather and obviously also the knowledge that he has. And I was, you know, very fortunate that, you know, my father really committed himself to, you know, saying that he wanted to give his knowledge to me as his child. And he was quite particular about saying as his child, not daughter, son, but it's a child. So I'm, you know, the one, you know, he only has two children, and I was the one that was really, you know, harassing him for for learning the Quran. I wanted to learn with him because that's the way it should be. And I knew that I could get so much knowledge from everything that he grew up, you know, learning very closely with his father, taught with his father. So he had so much knowledge and, you know, still does have so much knowledge. And now my son also studies with him. So it's continuing.
Well, great. But part of the tradition is also to build the instrument. And how can I imagine that? You choose some of the pumpkins from the field. You have to dry them and to hollow them out now. To hollow them out and then to dry them.
Yeah. I mean, they are gourds. I kind of don't use the word pumpkin because that's something you eat. Yeah. But the gourds is the calabash, exactly. Yeah. And you know, most instruments from that region of Africa are all made from have some use for calabash. It's something you see so many instruments in that region of Africa, not just in Mandeng. So yeah, it's a construction which I guess a lot of people say is very organic. Like you never have two chorus the same. It's not quite like, I mean, people say you can have two guitars the same because they are factory made. But interestingly, I find even the two guitars is very difficult. They all have a character, especially once you start to play them. And yeah, so I mean, the construction of the instrument actually was an area that I got super, super passionate about for quite a long time. I actually got to the point where that was a business for me in my time. I was in university, and just after I graduated from university, I was focusing mostly on building and exporting chorus. My mother actually was professional in carpentry, and so I learned quite a lot of carpentry and art side from her, and I applied that into construction because I wanted to develop a new kind of hybrid chora, which was more suitable for traveling and, you know, touring and putting them in airplanes and, you know, towing up into freezing cold countries. And it's very difficult to travel with the choras that I had and I was using at the time, even though the sound was much better. And so I was trying to sort of create an instrument that was more modern, but at the same time didn't sacrifice the sound quality. So that was a lot of years of working really hard on that. And the chora I play today is one of the ones that that I built during that time. I actually built it to sell to someone, but I ended up keeping it. Didn't know I'd end up, you know, becoming my instrument for the next 15 years or however long it has been.
Instrument of your heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Crazy. So yeah, that side of things is very, I'm also very passionate about. I stepped away from it because I just didn't have the time anymore. It's very time consuming, you know, doing that. But I've worked with training other people in the Gambia in how to build them with the techniques that I developed and continued some of that business over the years as well. And yeah, I will probably return to it again. I've left it a little bit again because of time, but something I would probably like to return to at some point in the future.
So if I understood it right, it's not the traditional instrument. It's modified and
it's really the neck of the instrument. That's the really part that's the innovation, because that is where you have, you know, most of the problems with climate and so on. So yeah, the neck of the instrument has been definitely modernized and developed, but the sound still retains. And that was the part that I took a lot of time. My great uncle, which is the brother of my grandmother, was the master chora maker for the whole, you know, for Gambia. All the professional chora players would have their choras made by him. And I was fortunate that we had so many of his choras, you know, at home. So I spent a lot of time, because he passed away by the time that I was really interested in construction. And so I started to literally unmake his choras slowly. so that I could see the way he built it. So I was doing it in reverse to really learn how his systems of construction were, so that I could preserve as much as possible of the techniques he used in building Koras. Even though you're modernizing it, you are still using some of those really important techniques that he used to build. And I think this is what is really important. And, you know, my Kora, the scarf, people often ask me the scarf, I have the red scarf. That's really, for me, I put that there for a homage to him, actually, because he made the Koras and he uses the red fabric at the front of the instrument, but only me can, I can see it because the way it's facing. So I put the scarf there, you know, as a kind of recognition of his amazing mastery as a maker. He didn't play Kora, but he made them, you know, and so everyone have their specialization, you know.
And the sound is also made from the strings. Yes, of course, the strings, but also the openings on the sides, I think.
Yeah, there's a sound hole, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have one, not on both sides, just on one side, the sound hole, yeah, for that. So, yeah.
And is it as hard to keep it as it looks like, or is it
to keep it, meaning to hold it?
Yeah, to hold it, yes.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, maybe maybe I've done it for a while, so I don't want to say yes, and somebody will say no, it isn't. So I don't know, but I guess I'm used to it. Yeah, I'm used to it.
Yeah,
it's been a while.
You trained it since you were very little child. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, you stood on stage since you were 3 or 4 years old, I think.
It's been a while.
Yeah. But do you remember from this very...
little bits, not much. No, not much. It's a blah. So, but of course, people ask, do you remember where you started? I guess I can say, no, I don't. It's sort of like a music, you faded in. And that's like, you know, that's my memories faded in. Yeah.
But then you did something very different because you studied cello and you studied also piano and harpsichord.
Yeah.
So very different things.
Traditions,
And on a university which is very popular and very hard to come in. So how is it going together for you now, the very traditional side and this? Your professor said there's no way to come out with traditional instruments, I think. And
what I think really gave me a comfortable place in that journey was really coming into composition, you know, and when I started to focus on composition as a primary study in the Western classical tradition, it gave me space to not have to abandon totally the Kora and my whole background in order to, you know, sort of be in this area, because Western classical music is incredibly focused and, you know, you cannot diversify your interests. And that was something that was very much drummed into me in music school in those years, that, you know, I was always reminded, you know, if you want to do this, it's all or nothing. It's not half and half. So there was years where I totally left the Kora, didn't touch the Kora, didn't play the Kora, didn't practice it. It was all like 100% focus. It's like, okay, I knew that was not going to last forever because I can't take it out of me. It's a part of my genetics, part of my DNA, part of how I feel and think. So I came back to it, and that's where composition became the safe place for me. I think it was very difficult certain years being that far away from the tradition and that culture, and that didn't feel natural to me. But interestingly, as I grew older, and as a university, I started teaching Kora and designing courses for postgraduate students. That's really the time I started to really draw on the positive side of what I took out of that, those years of real focused study in Western classical music, where at the time I felt like I'm abandoning things. But actually, it was a healthy experience because it really taught me about a different approach to studying music, right? A very different way of studying to the way that I learn in the culture of the griot tradition. It's very, very different. And so I was able to use that kind of approach and also apply it to what I was doing in measured quantity that I felt was healthy and not obviously just transplanting something, but also helped me design courses. It helped me really analyze things differently because there's a very different approach to music in Western classical music. And I think it opens up your perspective a little bit to think about things in more than one way. And I think that was a very unique experience for me to have had the benefit of having.
And how long did you study in London? Besides, you did also studies in African culture and composition on
of course,
the Purcell.
Yes, the Purcell School. Yeah, so I started that 14 and I went through till 20 something. 22 or so, 23, I can't remember now. Yeah, so almost 10 years went through the system. But as I said, I think went on a very big journey. But by the time I was 17, I knew that, okay, this is not gonna, I can't continue this fully. I have to go. And that's when I started studying with my dad as well. So I'd find time. At that time, he lived in Norway. So it was a little easier because I could then just get on a flight and visit him in Norway and study. And I would do that where I go and it's like close the door, focus, and literally hours and hours a day, and just studied intensively with him, intensively for some years.
But then you decided to go to Gambia, to the Gambia.
Yeah, I went back around 2014 or so. And, you know, I also had my son by that time and I was very determined to make sure he had a similar experience to me, where he grows up in Africa and understands the culture, and that becomes a normal part of his life. So it was really important to me, and some other schools in Gambia. But then when I opened my academy 2015, he then joined the academy from then and until now.
Yeah, let's talk about the academy. It's a very big project you are concerned in. Yeah, you build it up. And I think it's part of the tradition of a guide to tell stories, to keep the tradition alive, to give something personal to the stories you are telling. And maybe this is the same what you are doing with the school and the cultural, to have really the background for these people, not only to have knowledge about science and math and whatever. So to keep the traditions, but I think you know it best.
Yeah, I mean, of course, yes, it's partly tradition. I think contextually for me, it's more about resetting the education system and the orientation of the education to do what should be basically normal, which is to orientate around the culture identity of the people who are going through the system. And it's really a matter of raising awareness, because I think sadly, most of the world kind of doesn't realize how strongly impacted Western culture has affected the globe. So much so that it's like you have to point it out, and then people are like, oh yeah, you know, it's so normalized that we don't even question it. It's almost like that becomes the foundation. And for me, what I'm really pushing back on is that does have a detrimental effect on young people growing up in another country when their baseline is based on a culture that doesn't belong to them. And so this is really not really something I'm trying to do that is kind of innovative, or I'm not trying to do something any complicated. I'm actually just trying to do something that should be normal and logical and expected in any civilization, right? I would expect coming to Germany that, you know, the education system at least recognizes that it's teaching German children and that they should be able to speak German in school and they should learn about the history of Germany and all these basic things. It shouldn't be like, oh my God, it's amazing you learn German history in Germany. That's the situation we have in Africa, where it's amazing that you guys are learning African history. And for me, that's what irritates me. It's like, why is that amazing? Why isn't that normal? Why is it something special? You know, and so really it's more kind of raising awareness, first of all, to how much we need to, first of all, re-examine how much we have taken for granted somebody else's culture. For example, a lot of people ask me, you know, repeatedly, especially in Africa, or not just in Africa, but, you know, yeah, many parts, but especially in Africa, a lot of people ask me and say, you know, that you singing in Mandinka and, you know, you didn't think to sing in English. And I think that's the mental orientation that I'm fighting against. That why is that the first question you ask? Why are you not asking all the artists who are born and raised in Gambia singing in English? Why are you not asking, why did you choose English? You know, why is it me you're asking? Why am I singing in Mandinka? Well, because we speak Mandinka here. That's why. And I'm playing Mandinka music and I'm playing a Mandinka instrument. And guess what? I'm going to sing in Mandinka. That shouldn't be a question. So it's really about questioning the fact that our brains are just conditioned to see the world through the lens of Western culture. Even as Africans, we have been conditioned to do that. And it's education that has done that, because people that ask me that question have been brought up in an education system where speaking English is the norm, right? Where, you know, going to school and you know, learning all about European history, wearing European clothes to school, you know, kind of pretending to be European when you're not and you've never stepped foot outside of your village before. That's all creating a mindset that that sets people on a trajectory. And we talk about, and we kind of, you know, there's global discussions always going on all the time about the issues of migration, the issues of people, you know, but from my point of view, it's not about migration, it's abandonment. It's the fact that we are losing some of the greatest minds out of our countries, that we need those minds, we need the youth, we need people with that, you know, critical thinking and entrepreneurship, energy and all the rest of it to be contributors to the development of our nations. And we're losing them, you know, but well, what do you expect when you train people from day one to revere and look up to a culture that is not their own? And so what I'm doing is allowing these students to grow up on a daily basis, learning to revere and respect and look up to their own culture. And naturally, you start to create younger citizens who feel very passionate about contributing to the economic development, social development, infrastructural development, healthcare development of their own nation. And that's the type of citizens I think we need, not just in the Gambia, but across the continent.
Mm. So to have a basis to develop entrepreneurs, people who want to, right. to make a change in, right. in West Africa.
Absolutely.
Or in Africa.
Absolutely. And, yeah. Mm. That starts in school.
So that's the base for everything. What
to... Absolutely. It's the base for everything. Yes. Yes. It's the vision for me. The academy is my way of proving what I've been saying or wanting to say. What I'm saying is not by no means new, but it is, I think, just not enough people have been actively doing it in large numbers. So I wanted to be able to, you know, put this message across, not through sort of saying this is what I believe, but now being able to say this is what happens. And now 10 years down the line, I'm actually in that position where I have students now that are becoming those examples of exactly what I'm trying to prove. And now I don't have to speak so loud because I can say, look, the, you know, what these students are going into, the impact that they're making on their country, their mindset, their way of thinking, their critical approach, their leadership and all these things. And this is something that I want to see. And now I'm able to prove that it's possible.
And how does it start? Now you have an academy with a few hundred students, I think. Or?
Well, no, we are opening up in September. We have, because we've just completed literally 3-4 months ago, something like that. We've now completed the new campus, which is a dedicated campus for us to be able to sort of now expand our curriculum, which is major, we've been waiting for. So we are opening up the new campus in September, so we can now take on all the extra students that we wanted to take on, which would take up to about 150 students, which would be, you know, obviously able to now impact many. But the goal is still not, for me, the number of students we have within the walls of the academy. What is the goal for me is the curriculum and making sure that we can get this curriculum into as many schools as possible. The academy is just the blueprint. It's just the hub. It's like the center point. But what is important to me is the work that we're doing through collaborating with the education authorities, not just in the Gambia, but outside of the Gambia, and making sure that we can get elements of this curriculum, at least initially elements of the curriculum, within government schools and other schools across the country and outside of the Gambia. That's the main goal.
And is it helpful that you are a musician and you are recognized for all these things and through the tradition and so on?
Yeah, this is, it is absolutely. So my career is a platform. It just allows my voice to be a little louder, you know, which is helpful when you're trying to do work like this. It's, you know, I see so many organizations who are doing amazing work, but really struggle, you know, to get the recognition and get the platform for people to really support what they're doing. So this, and of course, is a huge assistance to the work that I'm doing. The fact that I do have the platform, I have the ability to speak to people all over the world and have that opportunity to connect with people about this work and the importance of it. So I try to utilize that as much as I can, which for me is one of the most important critical things that we can do as artists and musicians, is really to make sure that we bring meaning to what it is that we do.
Yeah, you spoke in the UN. Yes. I think you had a speech there. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. I've done a lot of work with them and different UN bodies, UNICEF, UN Habitat, especially as ambassador for them for a while, and have worked with the, you know, ITC and all these sort of organizations. But it's, you know, I'm always kind of the voice of criticism, I always say. But I guess it's also a critical part of development and growth to also be able to listen to those criticisms and be able to also, I think, put the mirror very frankly on what the approaches that are undertaken when it comes to so-called development in Africa. And that's what I've been very critical of, especially for some of the bigger organizations in their approaches to development on the continent is where I criticize sometimes a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, you play the choral, you play, but also other instruments, traditional instruments. The people on your academy will learn them too. But you also sing, and I think singing is the nearest instrument you have, so it's very normal to sing. But yeah, how do you train it by yourself in your career?
Yeah, it's funny. I always say that I'm not a singer. Like, I have to say that, and I say that because I know what it takes to be, you know, a choral player. I know what it takes to learn the cello, the piano, you know, all these instruments that I've studied. And, you know, in those institutions, you have people who are vocalists, and the level of training is no different. You know, the level of commitment and dedication and hard work and all the rest of it. And so I always say I'm not actually a singer, because I didn't train in singing. I trained, you know, heavily in all the instruments that I've done. The voice was the one thing that I've just always just never done anything with it. I just opened my mouth and just whatever. I never intended to sing. You know, the only reason I ended up singing was an artist that I was working with many, many, many years ago from Gambia also. And I was asking him, his name Jule Kamara. He plays he's a Fula musician, plays the Nyanyeru, which is a traditional instrument from belonging to the Fula people. And I was asking him to help me find a vocalist for songs that I was writing, which were some of the songs that I wrote. And he was starting to help me find these vocalists, and he suggested a few. I didn't like them. And so it was kind of back and forth. And I was like, ah, no, I don't like that, I don't like that. And I remember very clearly he came to London. And we were on a train from somewhere to somewhere. And I just remember that moment where I was holding onto the train and he's looking at me with this funny face, smiling and sort of saying, because I was saying, no, I don't like the latest one he sent me. I was listening. I said, no, it's not quite right. And he's just looking at me as if like, you know, you're crazy, right? Because he heard my demo and he said, why don't you do it yourself? I don't understand why you're searching for a singer. Like, sing it. And I'm like, no, you're crazy. No way. That was the beginning. That was the beginning. And fast forward, it was not immediate. Obviously, I was like, ah, forget it. It took maybe a couple of years for it to slowly go in, and a lot of failed attempts to find someone to sing it the way I wanted it. And every time I failed to find the right thing, that thing came to my head again, and his expression and the way he looked at me, that comes to my head again. He's just like, I don't know what's wrong with you. And and I thought, okay, I'm just going to sing it and just sing it. And that's that. I just thought, oh, no. You know, when you do it and you're like, oh, just put it out before you can. So I've always felt like that about singing. It's just something I did because I couldn't find someone to do it. So,
but in the Grai tradition, it's part of it to tell the stories and our opinion makers and
but
yeah,
still
shapers.
Singers and people who sing, they're not necessarily the same. You know, there are people who are accomplished singers, you know, mm-hmm. and we have them in this tradition, of course, who are my role models, you know, like Kasamadi Jabate, you know, is one of the greatest singers of our tradition. You know, and these are people who are, you know, absolutely, you know, phenomenal. I cannot put myself anywhere close to something like that. But of course, you know, a lot of people who play the choir, especially from the older generations, they all sing, because it's not about necessarily being a singer. It's about the storytelling. It's about the relevance and the cultural history that the role, and it has to be sung. So it's not necessarily about having an amazing voice or being a great singer. It's about the story, the content, the words that matter. But that doesn't mean we don't have amazing singers that take that as a lead, and a lot of women have done that and are, you know, very well-known singers that represent the culture, both from generations before and currently now too as well.
But you, as a first chora player, women chora player, how do you feel? What happened to you? Is it very natural for the people that you do that now, because it's very new role model?
Yeah, it's different. All I can say, it's been a very different journey. Like, if you look at the journey that you will undertake as a player, if I was a male, it's been a very different journey to the one I've taken to come to where I've come to now. And I would say mostly in the two areas. One was the method of training. It was very private, you know, chora, learning chora and any of the instruments that belong to the griot. It's very communal. You know, you learn in the community, you learn, you know, by going to the ceremonies with whoever's your mentor, whether it's your father or whoever. Like, my father went with his father to these ceremonies, and he grew learning on the job, you know, as well as studying at home and so on. For me, it was secret. It's just like lock the doors, like I said. And that's why it was great that my father was in Norway, because it's an isolated place. It would have been very difficult and very different if he was in the Gambia at that time. So it was a blessing that he was in Norway, and it was just something that nobody knows about except me and him. And I did not step out in front of anyone to play until I felt I was strong enough. And it was a lot of pressure on myself to, you know, am I ready? I'm like, no, I'm not ready yet. I'm not good enough. I have to really work hard. So it was a big deal to finally step out in front of the family, in front on the public eye, finally to be, okay, I'm going to play this instrument, and you're going to see that this is not just a hobby. This is now going to be something I want to do professionally. And having the support of my father was critical at that. It's almost like, you know, having his support also gives me a level of acceptance, you know, that it's not just me deciding it. He's also accepted it and embraced it. So that was very important. And the second is more that I was very, very careful, and still to this day, you know, that my place is on the stage. You know, no one sees me play anywhere else except on the stage. And that is also one of the reasons why I think I've been able to be, you know, I haven't, you know, cause too much disruption to things, because the stage is a neutral space in many ways. It's a new thing. It doesn't belong to the culture in that way. It's something that is seen as something very different and outside of the tradition.
It's artificial, so, a little bit.
Yeah. And so it kind of has it's kind of like a protected space in a way, right? It's hard to pass judgment who comes up on a stage in an audience, right? But if I was to go to a naming ceremony, or I'm going to go to a traditional event and put myself there in front of men, it becomes a very different dynamic. And so I've been very careful and consistent with that my place is on the stage, and that's where I'm positioning myself. Yeah. Except now I would say the only way now I'm feeling that now things are changing a little bit is because of the academy. This is very culturally rooted, very rooted in real life. And obviously now my role is very much more integrated, but not so much necessary as a chora player. It's more as an educator. So it's slightly different.
But your career as a chora player helps the academy to have attention.
Absolutely.
And when does it start that your son was now in your band? How is it to play for you with him?
You said, you know, I can't remember when I started. I can't even remember when he started. So it's the same thing, you know. He was one of those children that he was always stressed to not be involved. Yeah, so I felt like a very bad mom when I have to leave him at home. And sometimes I will not tell him I'm going to do a concert, because if he knows, he will start crying. And that's like from the age of four, you know, four or five, he has to be around music. So it was easier for me just to include him, because it was too stressful trying to lie to him and say, I'm not doing anything. It's not music. It's, why are you carrying your car? You're going to play a concert, I know. So yeah, for me, it was so easy, and it was always, you know, way better. And obviously I know this is a thing that women face, you know, it's difficult to have children and still conduct a career at that level. And you do so many sacrifices to be a mom, because children at that age are so dependent, obviously naturally dependent on the mom and connected to the mothers. So it was very difficult at times, you know, and I have a daughter also. So it's been difficult to kind of separate from that kind of commitment to being a mom, but at the same time, including too. So him being into music helped me big time, because it meant I didn't have to, you know, sacrifice my role as a mom. I could get have him on the road, and it's something that he's loved and grown up around and had an amazing, like, you know, you could never pay for that experience that he's had, to travel around the world, be around my band, you know, top musicians that he's been listening to, and being around, like, it's just all his uncles, you know, and for them too, you know, it's nice hearing from them, because they've seen him since he was, you know, a little baby and growing, and now he's, you know, launching his own career. It's a very special thing, and I think the fact that I've have that opportunity to allow, you know, to be able to give that to my child, I would never not do that, you know. It's too priceless, you know. You can't learn that in school. So yeah, school of life, I say.
School of life. So you need your voice on stage, you have to play.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
Take care. All right.
Das war der Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie mit ausgewählten KünstlerInnen aus unserem Programm. Wenn du keins der Gespräche verpassen willst, abonniere uns doch einfach auf deiner Lieblingsplattform und lass natürlich gern immer eine Bewertung da. Für Tickets und Infos zu den Konzerten in Elbphilharmonie und Leishalle besuche uns auf www.elbphilharmonie.de. Dort findest du in der Mediathek auch weitere Podcast-Formate sowie viele Konzertstreams, Interviews, Hintergrundartikel und spektakuläre Musikvideos.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.